On the Book Show with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Welcome to a new year, and we start off looking at three different authors who are going to talk about great iconic songs and great iconic songwriters. What a great way to open our 32nd year on the air.
We're talking today to Mark Myers, whose new book, Anatomy of 55 More Songs, The Oral History of Top Hits That Change Rock, Pop, and Soul, from Groove Press, which is a follow-up to his 2016 smash bestseller, Anatomy of a Song. He collected 55 oral histories of iconic songs based on his popular Wall Street Journal column.
Great, Dave. How about you?
I am very well. Enjoyed your book very much.
Thank you.
So the criteria for choosing the songs in the book, you had three of them. These are what makes these songs particularly interesting.
For a song to have made my book, it had to have been a great song that people know but haven't heard in a while. It also had to be iconic, meaning it stood the test of time. If I just did songs that happened yesterday, in 10 years from now, we might think they're junk. So I needed to give a little bit of a lapse of about 25 years. So I had to go back at least 25 years to find them and then go back further than that. But these songs also had to be, they had to have changed music history in some way. There had to have been some transformation that happened as a result of them. And in each case in the book, in Anatomy of 55 More Songs, each of these songs played a role in changing the shape and the direction of the genre they were in, and sometimes other genres.
I've got to completely agree with you. For most of the years that you cover, I've been in the radio business, so I had the privilege of playing a lot of these songs, playing them when they were brand new songs, like Roundabout. Wow. So that's really fun to see songs that I recognize, and I remember their impact, and I remember what a difference they made in the lives of listeners from our perspective here in a radio station. A number of songs that are in this list, Grammy Hall of Famers. Not all of them, but quite a few of them, which is significant, I think, too.
To make the Grammy Hall of Fame, that's just an interesting insight because not many get in there, and there's always a reason why they're in there. So for me, to just mention that, if a song did have that achievement, it's good for the reader to know that, because it tells the reader that there were people who know a lot about music who thought this song was an important game changer for the culture. That's why the Grammy Hall of Fame isn't like the Wheel of Fortune, where a wheel is turned and a song is picked. There's a lot of thought that goes into what songs are going in, and someone has to provide a pretty good rationale for why they want it in.
One of the songs that I like the most of all of the list is a song that always seemed, in a way, emblematic of the era of kind of middle part of the 1960s, when there was still a lot of happiness going on. There was a change in it, and that's The Fifth Dimension's Up, Up, and Away. The wonderful thing about your book, too, is you interview not just the composer, in this case Jimmy Webb, but also Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis Jr., who were two of the members of The Fifth Dimension that later broke out and they got married, and they had their own duet, and then it's a great story. So tell us the story of Up, Up, and Away.
I mean, Up, Up, and Away, in short, was a song that Jimmy Webb wrote while he was in community college. And it was just something he was just playing with until he had a radio host in from the West Coast who was a friend of his. He had him in San Bernardino, and he said, "Hey, listen to the song. What do you think?" And the guy said, "Hey, this song would be great for a movie. Balloons. Like, you know how the kids are on the beach with beach movies? I really want to do a movie about a screenplay about kids and ballooning." Now, that sounds absurd to me. I know it sounds absurd to you, but, you know, it's Southern California, so you got to give them a little slack. And long story short, you know, he takes Jimmy out to this hot dog stand near L.A., in San Bernardino, and at the hot dog stand, there's this big balloon with the name of the radio station on it, and he takes Jimmy up in this balloon. The balloon went up like 100 feet. It was tethered, but that was the gag, that if you won a contest for the radio station, if you called in, you got taken up a little bit in the air, and you could see everything around you, and it was so exciting. He takes Jimmy up, and Jimmy's looking up through the balloon, and it looks like stained glass to him. He can't believe how the sun is playing off of it, and he knows what the song is about. He knows what he wants to do with it, and the movie never got made, but that song went to the fifth dimension and became a blockbuster hit, as you know.
Another song that's on your list is Tommy James and the Shondells' Crystal Blue Persuasion. I, like probably most people who've ever heard the song, always thought it had something to do with psychedelics. It was the era, after all. But as it turns out...
Isn't that an amazing story?
Yes.
It's the complete opposite. It was actually a biblical reference. It was the book of Revelations. A kid came up to him after a concert, I think it was down south, and handed him a sheet of paper with a poem and a title on it that said, I think it was Crystal Blue. And no, it was Crystal Persuasion. That's what it said on the top. And you know, Tommy James, you know, looked at it, and the kid, you know, had his glasses on, his white shirt and tie, and he thanked the kid. And the kid really loved Tommy James. There's something about Tommy James. The kid just loved the music. And the kid disappeared, and Tommy took that back to the hotel, and it was a poem that the kid had written on the Book of Revelation. And Tommy and the group set words to it. They used a little influence from Groovin' by the Rascals to create that nice summery beat with a conga playing, that little Latin sound. And Crystal Blue Persuasion is about a reference inside Book of Revelation. You know, it's just amazing.
Another song that's on your list is a song, I have to admit, is one of the songs that always cheers me up when I hear it on the radio. It's just such a joyful song, Ain't No Mountain High Enough. The Diana Ross version in particular is the one where you interview people that were in the Supremes with her. You interview producers and Valerie Simpson, one of the writers. What makes this song so much of a pivotal song? Is it just the fact that Diana was leaving the Supremes to go off on her own, or what? There was more to it than that.
You know, the mind blower for me, Dave, is that when people heard, most people think the song that Diana Ross sings is different than the one Tammy Terrell and Marvin Gaye sang.
Right.
Ain't No Mountain High Enough. And in fact, it's the exact same song, but they did such an amazing job arranging it, where she's got this monologue, and then there's this build-up, and then there's this, almost this orgasmic crescendo, and she's just singing away. And I mean, the thing runs like 6 minutes, but it's like, it's a masterpiece for Diana Ross. It's her first solo, but it's a great example of how ingenious some of these people are, especially at Motown, where they can take an existing song, a song that has already been out and become a hit, a song everybody knows and is stamped in their head, and turn that into something symphonic and something so big that when you say to yourself, gee, it has the same kind of words as the old ones, but it can't be because it's a completely different song. And it wasn't. It was the same song, but it was really dressed up for the ball, really. I mean, it's just so glamorized.
There's one of the criteria that you had also was songs that always are misinterpreted, and Crystal Blue Persuasion is one of those. But another one is Jackson Browne's Doctor My Eyes. Oh, I always listen to the lyrics and I thought, oh, I know what he's talking about. He's talking about, you know, he's disillusioned, or he's seeing things in a new way. It's so, but it really did have something to do with him going to the optometrist and having an eye issue, didn't it?
Well, that's the beauty, Dave, of asking a stupid question, which I always like. The dumber the question, I find, the more great information that comes out. And what I said to him was, I said, let me ask you, was something wrong with your eyes at the time? And he said, you know, there was. And he talks about how there was buildup on the eye and he couldn't quite solve it with drops and he had to go to the doctor. But as he quickly pointed out, nobody is going to write a song about a visit to the doctor. The doctor, Doctor My Eyes, was a metaphor for, I can't seem to see things in our society right anymore. Everything seems out of focus. Everything seems crazy. It became a vehicle for a socially conscious statement. But like all interesting things, like all great titles, you know, where did it come from? It came from his eye trouble.
I got time for one more question, and that is about Todd Rundgren's Hello, It's Me. I discovered from your book that two of my favorite jazz rockers, Michael Brecker and his brother Randy, who were in the original album of Blood, Sweat, and Tears as saxophone and trumpet player, they're part of the backup. This is an example of a relatively simple song that is beautifully produced, and which is not a surprise because Todd Rundgren's a great record producer, but it's so completely different than the kind of stuff that he was doing live. I was fascinated by that.
Yeah, Todd is an incredible producer and a multi-instrumentalist and also a visionary. So for him, it was a song about a breakup. The girl dumped him because his hair was too long and her father turned the hose on him when he walked her home. So basically what he does is he creates a song. But the beauty of that song is she dumped him. But when he decided to write the song, he said, I've got creative license. I can do what I want. In the song, I'm going to dump her. And that's Hello, It's Me. Those are the first words he imagined he would say if he called her to break up with her.
Well, Mark, it is absolutely a fun book. I really enjoyed reading it. I know that our listeners will enjoy it as well. And thank you for making time to talk to us today.
Dave, it was great being with you. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Our thanks again to Mark Myers for joining us to talk about his new book, Anatomy of 55 More Songs, The Oral History of Top Hits That Changed Rock, Pop, and Soul, from Groove Press.
There are two essential ingredients for an anthem. The first is timelessness. The second, more importantly, is universality. That's how Steve Balton begins his new book. We're delighted to welcome to WTBF Steve Balton, who's the author of Anthems We Love, 29 Iconic Artists on the Hit Songs That Shaped Our Lives, published by Harper Horizon. I finished your book last night and enjoyed it enormously, Steve, I have to tell you. Of all the 29 songs, most of them are ones that I remember playing on the radio in my career, but I do have to say that there are a couple of them that were particularly special to me, so I'm going to ask you about those couple while we have time, all right?
Great.
The Barry Manilow song, Could It Be Magic? This is a really unusual pop song, and yet it was wildly embraced, even though it starts off with Chopin. Can you tell us the story of how he came to write that and how he came to record it?
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that one, because I'm a huge Barry Manilow fan. And fun fact, the first two artists to say yes to this book, one was Gerard Way from My Chemical Romance, and the other was Barry Manilow. So having both of them in there really set the tone for being able to go so widely diverse with this. And Barry, Barry has so many songs. I thought maybe Copacabana was one, but he actually chose Could It Be Magic because he said that's the song that really changed his life and his career. And it's funny because he talks about the fact, my favorite story in that chapter, and he does talk about the writing and everything, but what I love the story he tells of, look, when he recorded that song, he was not planning on being a pop singer. He thought he was going to be, as he put it, a commercial jingle writer behind the scenes.
Right.
And then the song started to take off and become successful. So at that point, he's on tour with Bette Midler as her music director. He plays the show at Red Rocks. He's playing every night three songs in between her sets. He plays a show at Red Rocks, does Could It Be Magic, gets a standing ovation, and it was at that moment that he realized that he was going to be a pop singer. He realized that it was his place to be in front of the audience as well and not behind the scenes writing commercial jingle. So that's why he chose that song, is because it really is the song that changed his life.
Yeah.
And he tells a great story, too, about working with Tony Orlando in the beginning and how he hated that version because it was just too poppy.
Yeah.
But he went back to it years later and appreciated it. So that song is one that really went through so many changes. It was recorded three times before it even became a hit.
It's a great song. I remember when that song came out and we started playing it on the radio and I thought, what is this? This is cool, but who's ever heard of this? It was an amazing song. And I'm a huge fan of his too. And I remember seeing him in concert back in those days, and he did the very strange medley, the VSM, of all of the jingles that he wrote or sang on prior to his recording career. It was fascinating. One of them that really surprised me, and in a really wonderful way, was Linda Ronstadt, another one of my favorite singers. And I remember when she made the transition from being a pop star and a country star to being a really legit singer, and that's what she talked about when she talks about the song Skylark, which is a great, great song.
I love Linda Ronstadt, and to get her in this book, because she's what most of these artists I'd have long relationships with, I had never interviewed her before, and I had a friend who was able to connect me with her, which was amazing. And I will say, she is amazing, but she was probably the toughest interview in this book because she's so critical of herself.
Right.
So it's interesting. She chose Skylark because for her, she didn't really learn to sing until the 80s. And it's fascinating because, like, she will tell you, she can't listen to her version of Desperado, which Don Henley has said is one of the greatest songs of all time. So that's why she chose a song from the 80s. But she was wonderful. But yeah, for her, she's very critical of herself as an artist. So she didn't feel that she learned to sing until the 80s. And she talks about the fact, at that point, she starts getting comfortable with her own voice.
Mm-hmm.
And it was on the Standards record. And it's interesting because she talks about the fact she loves the trio record she did with Dolly Parton and Emmylou Harris because the focus just isn't on her.
Right.
So, and then there's one Spanish song whose title I will butcher, and it's in the book, so you'll have to get it.
Yes.
That she says is the favorite song that she ever sang.
Oh, that's funny. I remember when she first transitioned to Broadway and was doing Pirates of Penzance, and I thought, wait, is this the same Linda Ronstadt? And then when I heard her singing, I thought, oh my gosh. Wow, I've underrated her all these years. She's really got the chops. Another great song was Earth, Wind, and Fire, September,
which was not even a huge hit to begin with. It became one, but this was just something which I didn't know until I read your book, that this was just a song they kind of wrote for a filler on a greatest hits album that was a contractual agreement with their record label, right?
Yeah, it was a contractual agreement with CBS at the time, and I love that song, and that's one of my favorite interviews in the book because, it's such a fun song.
Yeah.
And Verdine White tells this story about people who, that song has become so meaningful to people, he cracks up. I mean, of course it's played at everybody's wedding because it's the feel-good party anthem of all time
right.
at this point, but also he talks about the fact that people will literally come up to him and say they've tried to have their babies on September 21st. It's absolutely hilarious. But that song, yeah, it was a filler song. They say they didn't even really start to play it live until the 80s because they had so many other hits, like
right.
After the Loving, songs like that. But The Template was a song, of all the songs in this book, that might be the one that's sort of taken on the most life of its own. And he says it really didn't become an anthem until the 90s. And then, of course, in the 2000s, they re-recorded it with Anna Kendrick and Justin Timberlake for the movie Trolls. So it gets introduced to all these kids.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also that great scene at the end of Night at the Museum with Ben Stiller and the all-time great Robin Williams, who's still one of my heroes.
Right.
And they play September in the last scene. So you literally see Theodore Roosevelt, Abraham Lincoln, all these great historical figures dancing to September. And to me, that's what it kind of becomes. The greatest literal party anthem of all time.
I've got to say, a lot of these songs got new life and a whole new audience because they were in movies. And I know one of my favorites on here, Tears for Fears, Everybody Wants to Rule the World. It's just everybody's 80s movie. The book is just full of wonderful stories like that. And I realize our time is short. And we could talk for at least a half an hour on these great stories. But I'm really appreciative that you worked me into your schedule this morning, and I wanted to tell you personally, I really enjoyed your book.
And I know we got to wrap up, but quick aside, Tears for Fears,
yeah.
Roland Orzabal did not want to finish that song. His wife made him finish it, and it's funny because he says it's become like a time travel song, but that's a song that's taken on new life in other ways. Lord redid it for Hunger Games, and they loved her version so much, they actually play that as their intro music and then open with their version.
Oh, funny.
So all these songs have taken on different lives, from cover versions, from being in movies, so yeah.
Marvelous, marvelous. Steve Bouton, thanks you so much, and I hope you have a great day today. Thanks for a great book.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Other songs in the book, The Temptations' My Girl, The Beach Boys' God Only Knows, who Paul McCartney thinks is the greatest pop song ever written, including all of his, Neil Diamond's Sweet Caroline, the Fifth Dimension's Aquarius, Let the Sunshine In, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Our House. Those of you who have listened to Book Bits before know the story of that, as well as Don McLean's American Pie. We interviewed Don McLean 2 years ago, and you probably remember that. Carly Simon's Anticipation, Janis Ian's marvelous anthem At 17, Hall & Oates' Sarah Smile, Chic's La Freak, Toto's Africa, and Shania Twain, You're Still the One, among many others. Hope you enjoyed this little quick look at Steve Bouton's Anthems We Love, 29 iconic artists on the hit songs that shaped our lives, and we might say change theirs too. It's published by Harper Horizon. We are talking to David Leaf, who is the author of God Only Knows, Brian Wilson, The Beach Boys, and The California Myth. He's also an award-winning writer, producer, and director. The book is a pickup from the original book, which was The Beach Boys and the California Myth that came out in 1978. And then you did kind of an updated version of that in 1985. But this one picks up the story from 1985 and brings it forward, right?
That's exactly right. The original book was written, I was a young journalist on a mission to tell Brian's story and kind of bring his artistry to the world in a way that I didn't think had been done. Now I'm an elder statesman looking back on this amazing journey that I've gone on with him. And so I get to tell stories that no one else can tell because I've been a fly on the wall for his artistic renaissance and his personal and creative redemption.
The wonderful thing about your book is that we get a real sense of what it was like for these guys when they were just teenagers and all of a sudden they have a hit record. And all of a sudden, the whole country is talking about how cool California is. And I've got to say, growing up in Daytona Beach, Florida, where I and a lot of my friends were surfers as well, for us it was like a validation. See, what we do is really cool. We're not just crazy people that go out and do these things. And so all of us that were boomers at that time, that grew up with the wonderful music of the 1960s of the Beach Boys, this is a wonderful chance to see what went on behind and all the different personalities and family issues. Mike Love, the first cousin, and all these things with the brothers. When you wrote the original book, what was the one thing that surprised you the most about what you learned?
One thing that surprised me the most, how modest Brian was. He just doesn't act like a superstar. I mean, this is a guy who Paul McCartney wants to meet. This is a guy who is influential on his generation and the subsequent generations as anybody in the history of popular music. And yet he knows that, but at the same time he's just a regular guy, and that surprised me. I also, in getting to know him, it was honestly sad to see that the weight of his experiences in life had worn him down to a certain degree.
Right.
And so that was what was so thrilling in working on this massive update, which is more than half the length of the original book. It's really a big update.
Really.
Yeah. So it's you're getting two books for the price of one. I wanted to make sure people who got the original book got their money's worth with this one.
Well,
and so for him to have come out of his shell, musically, personally, as a touring artist, was really, really rewarding, and to be part of all that was just amazing.
You know, I had read stories about him all along. And I remembered the 70s, and Dr. Land and the piano with the sandbox underneath it and all the stories that we heard. And you talk very honestly about all of those years. But one line stuck with me from that section of the book when you were talking about Brian dealing with all this pressure, dealing with the expectation that he was going to churn out the hits so the band could keep touring, so the Capitol could keep making money off them. And you said that all these things that he tried and his family tried to help him, but your comment was, it's just hard to heal heartbreak. He is a very sensitive man, and when a record that he poured his heart and soul into didn't sell a bunch of copies or was not well received in the press, it really hurt his feelings, didn't it?
Absolutely. I'll presume you're talking about Pet Sounds.
Yeah.
So Pet Sounds, which today is almost always in the top 10 or top 5 of the greatest albums of all time.
Right.
Which is an album that, as George Martin said to me, when we made Sgt. Pepper, it was our attempt to equal Pet Sounds. But when it came out, or when they were recording it, there was a lot of grumbling in the group that, doesn't sound like the old stuff. There was a concern that the Beach Boys audience wouldn't like this. And Capitol Records really sabotaged Brian. What they did was they pressed about 200,000 or 300,000 copies, sent them out to the stores, and when the stores reordered the album, instead of sending out more copies of Pet Sounds, the Capitol Records sent out what they called Best of the Beach Boys. And usually a greatest hits album signals your career is over.
Right.
So the record company was like, okay, let's milk this one more time while we still have the chance. And so Pet Sounds was not the million seller that Brian had hoped for. It wasn't a lot of rock press back in 66.
Right.
The British went nuts for Pet Sounds. The British embraced it. The few record reviewers like Richard Goldstein loved it. But there was no Rolling Stone magazine in those days, so there wasn't the critical acclaim he could point to and you say, "See, I was right. It's great."
Yeah.
There was nothing other than sales numbers.
It seems to me that the labels never really appreciated what kind of incredible talent they had in Brian Wilson, or in the determination of the guys in the band to keep satisfying the people that came to hear them, that they just said, well, as long as you're selling records, we're happy.
I'm not so sure too much has changed. I'm not sure the record business has ever been it's called a business.
Right.
And so, if you're an artist, Brian Wilson is one of the greatest artists of all time, the record industry isn't really going to be sensitive to your needs. And as you said, Brian's really sensitive, so it was a lot of unhappiness that he wasn't being, his new music wasn't being welcomed. When he was making Good Vibrations, which was the follow-up single to Pet Sounds, and remember, Pet Sounds had four hit singles on it, Wouldn't It Be Nice, Luke John B., God Only Knows, and Caroline O.
Right.
So by any measure, it was a success, except from Capitol Records. Now he's going to make this new single that he calls Good Vibration, and he's working on it for months and months and months and months. And why are you spending so much money? Why is it taking so long? Why is the record going to be so long? Because in those days, singles had to be under 3 minutes.
Right.
And it became the Beach Boys' first million-selling number one. And it was always a battle. It was always a battle.
The later years that you bring us up to date on, these are incredible years where people of great renown are talking openly about what a genius Brian is, how much he influenced their considerable writing careers, their considerable performing careers. It's kind of wonderful news there. There's a turnaround, and Brian starts enjoying live performing again. I remember when this music started coming out around 2000, and from that point forward, I've been in radio since the early 70s, so I've seen all these progressions. But I've got to say, the stuff that he's been doing since, say, 2000 is really wonderful, and it's so exciting to see him happy again.
It surprised all of us, and as I write in the book, when I heard that he was going to go on tour, I thought, that's the worst idea I've ever heard. And I was 100% wrong. What I didn't know was he going to call me and say, hey, I'm going on tour, I need you to be there. I need what he called emotional security. But it was just thrilling to see how audiences were responding to him, and more significantly, how he was responding to audiences, because he thought if he went out by himself, nobody would show, nobody would be interested. Because he had been told, if you're not with the Beach Boys, you're nothing.
Mm.
So when I think the first show in Ann Arbor, Michigan, I don't know, 16, 17, 18 standing ovations. I mean, it was just amazing. And to watch him grow in the subsequent years. And you know, I think his solo career is worthy of him being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, just as Brian Wilson.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great thrill to get a chance to talk to you. And I just think it's so cool that you're a professor at the UCLA Herb Albert School of Music, because I'm a trumpet player. And Herb Albert was my first big hero as a musician. Thank you.
Well, Dave, you know, one of the things that's really funny is the room I teach in is called Lanny Hall, after Herb's wife, the great singer from Sergio Mendez. But I teach a course in the Beatles, and my department chairman wants me to do a course on the Beach Boys next.
Cool.
But the first day of class last spring, student raised his hand and he said, "Professor, are you going to be talking about the rivalry between the Beatles and Brian Wilson?" And so these kids are sharp.
Wow.
They are really smart. And I said, "You know, I really wasn't planning on it, but happy to talk about it if that's what you want to talk about."
Absolutely.
It's amazing how strong the music of the 60s has remained in terms of its place in our popular culture.
Yeah. I had a music professor in the early 70s who got asked about pop music, you know, what was going to survive. He said, there was crap in the 17th century, and we don't hear it anymore. He said, there is wonderful music in the 20th century, and they're going to be listening to it from this point forward. And he said, and the Beatles and the Beach Boys, they will never go out. They will never be lost. And that warms my heart to remember that.
That's a good professor, because, you know, from my point of view, Brian Wilson made the classical music of the 20th century.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, thank you again so very much. Thank you. And I sure enjoyed your book.
Thank you, Dave.
All right.
Hope everybody out there listening goes to Amazon and hits on God Only Knows.
Absolutely.
Take care. Thank you.
Our guest again has been David Leaf, award-winning writer, director, and producer whose feature credits include the Venice Film Festival favorite, The U.S. vs. John Lennon, the Grammy-nominated Beautiful Dreamer, Brian Wilson and the Story of Smile, The Night James Brown Saved Boston, Who is Harry Nilsson, as Why is Everybody Talking About Him?, as well as publishing the seminal The Beach Boys and the California Myth in 1978. He also wrote the Bee Gees authorized autobiography, and of course, his latest version of his original book, now twice as long, God Only Knows, The Beach Boys and the California Myth by David Leaf. Our thanks to Mark Myers, author of Anatomy of 55 More Songs, Steve Bolton of Anthems We Love, and David Leaf of Brian Wilson, The Beach Boys and the California Myth.
Happy New Year, and welcome back to On the Bookshelf. See you next time right here on your favorite radio station or podcast. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.